are to another episode of the Tetracast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. Once again, we've got the full crew here with me today. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Happy April.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Colizio.
Just doesn't stop. RPGs keep releasing. Kind of insane.
And Chow Min Wu.
How was your Easter?
It was pretty good. I didn't do anything special for it, but we went out for dinner. Me and my girlfriend went to a very, very Easter dinner. We went to a seafood boil where they basically serve you like shrimp and crab legs and everything, just basically in a giant bag of butter.
Oh yeah, I love those places. They give you like the napkins to like, you know,
yep,
and put on your lap and everything. Yep, and the bib.
Yeah, and basically, at the end of that, I was like, do I like seafood or do I just like butter? I don't know. Anyways,
nice.
That was my Easter weekend. But yeah, it is like Josh said, we are recording this on the 6th of April. We all already know that the back end of April is absolutely loaded with games. One of those games we'll be talking about a little bit this week because of a recently released demo that we're probably going to go into a fair bit of detail on. We also have a few surprises that we're going to be talking about this week. A little new surprising RPG indie project that showed up on Steam that both James and Josh have played. And we'll go into some new details for some upcoming summer games. And as always, a couple sales updates and release date updates. So starting out, I think we're going to have a few people interested in talking about this. One of the April releases in that Deluge releases in the last week of April is, of course, Saga Emerald Beyond. Now, we talked a little bit about this game over the last couple of weeks as Square Enix has been releasing the different like character trailers and detailing like how all the different characters have their own, you know, unique mechanics, unique capabilities, all different systems that play in that game. And of course, that same level of intricacy kind of tied itself into the demo as well. So the demo was made available just a couple of days ago on April 4th, a little bit earlier on consoles and then eventually on PC. And the interesting thing is that each demo has had in a different scenario available to play that will carry over into the release of the game. So I'm interested in talking about this, and this is probably going to be our first topic of the day. I've played the PC demo, I believe. Let me look at the list here. James has played, or Josh has played a little bit of the demo. James, you've also played a little bit of the demo.
You can just say that I've been playing the full game. The when the preview embargo lifted, the only stipulation is I can only talk about stuff that's in the demo. So gotcha. I can talk about like combat changes, and I can talk about like I can talk about Emea pretty much because that's the one character I've been playing that's in the preview. I just can't talk about anything past the point in the demo.
Gotcha. So. And then Josh, I assume you've been playing the PC demo, or did you play the PlayStation demo?
I played a little bit of the PlayStation demo. Played a bit of the PC one, and I heard a little bit about the Switch one, but I've dabbled between two.
Yeah, and we've talked about Saga on this podcast, not recently, but over the history of this podcast extensively across all of its different remasters and releases over the last couple of years. And I think we'll have a fair bit to talk about from the demo, because even though you can only talk about the, you know, early stages of the narrative, the story, the characters, there's a lot, the demo throws a lot of systems at you right away. That basically kind of we can compare and contrast to how it worked in Scarlet Grace, what we expect to see out of Emerald Beyond. And maybe we'll start out with James, and you're going to be able to talk about which character was available to your preview access?
All of them, because again, it was just like the full game.
Gotcha.
So I guess I can say that the reason I can only talk about Emea is that my first playthrough I did Bonnie and Fermina, so I can't talk about anything about that. But Emea is the witch girl whose whole thing is you raise her intelligence stat by finding cats, and every cat you find has its own portrait. It's like a real cat breed, and it gives you like intelligence and also might be a cat-themed weapon. Like, I picked up a cat, and I know this one's in the demo, so I can say it, and it turned into a Catling gun, which is a Gatling gun shaped like a cat that also gives you access to a cat, like another spell when you equip it.
So for people who've already feel lost because they're like, what the fuck is this game of Frizzly? So Saga Emerald Beyond, obviously the newest entry in the long, very long running Saga series. And this is not their direct sequel to like Scarlet Grace, not like narratively, like Saga's are pretty self-contained. And this new entry, like the main gimmick behind it is you have these six different characters, but split between five different routes because two of them are like a duo with Bonnie and Fermina. And the whole gimmick of this game basically is traveling in between different roles entirely. So for Ameya, it's kind of like a more modern setting that she starts out at, but then you can like go into like really bizarre places through this like Emerald Gate to like visit things like a land filled with like androids or something, or what could be like filled with undead and stuff like that. So like, and they all have very different quirks, right? Like that you're already highlighting, James, with like Ameya, she's very, her story, her plot is very cat centric. And then like, but with other characters, like say like Mido or Diva, like their routes are very, very different in theme and in different and in like characters involved as well. Like Mido is like Kagutsu puppets, and Diva has a very mech element to it.
Well, Diva, her starting party is a bit of everything. Like you have I guess this is like a good like a jumping on point to talk about the different kind of races in this game, because that was not a thing in Scarlet Grace,
right?
So you have like fiend. Well, you have monsters which learn abilities by defeating enemies and basically taking their skills for their own. You have mechs which don't learn abilities, but rather can only use abilities that are inherent in the equipment that you like attach to them.
And let me just jump in real quick to say that the monster thing is very Saga 2. That mech thing is very Saga Frontier. It's kind of pulling in from different games in the series.
So, yeah, yeah, I think one thing that you can very easily say about Emerald Beyond, even from just looking at the demo, is that it is a melting pot of a bunch of ideas from Saga games of the past. Like, I think the one thing that a lot of Saga fans have said is that it very much feels explicitly like, what if Saga Scarlet Grace was also had a sequel that was also Saga Frontier 3? Because it's a very it's very, very interesting in the fact that like you have all these different disparate worlds. Some of them in like the preview materials that we've gotten up to this point, like there's a world where it's literally just, hey, you're talking with literal red and white blood cells.
Oh yeah. Those are the press packets that we got. And I think it's interesting to kind of see this demo go out in a public audience, because like people who play Saga know what they're in for, but people who expect like a quote unquote normal RPG from a Saga game aren't gonna really get it, because like this demo for Saga fans has been like the general reception has been positive, but like for like the average person who's played it, I think it's a very divisive demo, because they don't know what to expect from Saga. They maybe they've never played a Saga game, they've never seen a Saga game, so they go in there and they're like, what the fuck is this? Because
Saga in general. I mean, we even got one of our staff here. It's like, you know, he never played a Saga game before. He tried it. He's like, what the hell is going on? Is there tutorials? But like,
Because the presentation part of it is very, Adam has used this phrase before. It trims the fat out of like a lot of the presentation aspects of RPGs. It gets to the point very, very fast. A lot of the gameplay, like it kind of gets you into like the game itself very fast. And like the narrative, it's like it's there to provide you a framework, a main objective of what you're working towards. But like the way you get there is totally up to you, and the story and the plot elements are over very quick. Like the dialogue exchanges are very quick in Saga games. They're not very wordy. And like you said, Chow, like Saga games usually don't have like heavy tutorial sections. They'll explain stuff to you when you come across them, especially in this demo, but it's like the very basics. And like, if you really want to get your feet wet like and truly understand like what's going on, you have to like go into the options, go to tutorial tips, and then it'll give you like a whole bunch of fucking like, you know, descriptions of very different mechanics that it doesn't outwardly explain to you.
Yeah, they would never spell it for you in a Saga game. Yeah. You have to figure it out yourself most of the time, basically.
I will say one change that specifically Emerald Beyond has made for to try and make the tutorialization a lot better. And it kind of necessary because Scarlet Grace's battle system was already complicated as it is. And this adds like a couple more layers on top of it. Every time you see something new in a playthrough, it'll actually have a pop up. And I believe this is something they kind of did in Minstrel Song as well, which I haven't played yet. It just like the first time you glimmer a tech, it'll act. It'll say, hey, so this is what happened. The first time you encounter an interrupt, it'll tell you what happened. Same thing with a chain, a pursuit. I believe spells. It, like, the game is telling you, okay, so you might not know what just happened. Here's a quick explanation, just so you have a general idea of what the hell's going on in the current moment.
But like auxiliary system is like, it'll never tell you this is how a monster works. You know, like if you're going into it and you have like a werewolf party member, it's like, why can't I switch out the weapons for this party member, but not for this party member? It's like, it's one of those things that's like, you kind of, if you're looking for answers, that's something that the tips are. It's like, hey, this game has different races that have different capability.
I have two comments. One, James is right in that Minstrel Song did do this when it, like, whenever you'd first hit a combo or a certain technique or whatever, it would have some pop-ups. But basically, going off of Chao's comment from a couple of minutes ago about low tutorials, figuring things out for yourself, it's kind of intentional. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Kawazu's on record, and he's done several interviews where he basically grew into gaming playing Ultima games back when he was young that were not translated into Japanese. So he was playing them in English, not really knowing English. And he kind of had to like figure the game out as he went. And he actually found like intrigue in that and just basically playing the game, failing sometimes, figuring it out as you go and learning that way, like that sense of discovery. And it might sound silly, but he kind of brings in that philosophy into Saga games where it may not explain everything to you, like with some, you know, highly detailed dictated set of rules, but the rules are there. You just need to like play it and figure them out. Now, later games or more recent games do have more tutorials than earlier games, but there's still a little bit of that sense of just, how does the game work? Well, just figure it out, play it and figure it out. That's part of the philosophy, I think.
Yeah, and the interesting thing before we really dig into the combat here, because the combat obviously is kind of the star of the show in this game, is like just kind of the shifts in narrative structure in this game compared to like older Saga entries, where this game for the most part has like an overhead of the mess. Like when you go into a world, it's not like a full 3D over the shoulder render of the world. It's like, hey, you're kind of like, you see an overworld map of the place that you're in, and you can go scan the area and see all the relevant places that you can go to. From there, and from there, it can be like, it could be just be a battle, it could be a series of like, you know, small scenes that like lead into like a mini quest line for that world. And then this all kind of is pretty, once again, I'd say streamlined, in the sense that like it kind of gets you to the point very fast. It conveys the point of what you're doing that you would in normal RPGs, but like in a very, very efficient fashion. You know, it's like, okay, I know what I need to do. I know where I need to go because I scanned this area when I went into this world. I see this overview map. I get to move my character model to whatever seems interesting. It doesn't give you a checklist of like, hey, go do this next. It's like, here's a series of like places you can interact with. You kind of get a gist of like what's gonna happen. Like, here's what's gonna, like, this is like say this team of people or scientists in this world are like doing monster research, and that's like the only thing that like it gives you about it. It's like, oh, maybe that's interesting. Or then there's another place of interest in that scan. It's like, hey, there's this another team that's like dealing with biochips. You know, it's like, oh, does that sound more interesting? And it's one of those things like you kind of just like kind of pick and choose what you want to do and like go from there. There's no like right answer of like how to proceed forward necessarily on like what will get me like the best equipment. It's kind of like, just what's interesting to you at that time, you know? And I really like that part of Saga, because that's a philosophy that's like kind of gone like with multiple games series.
So I'm kind of like the relative normie here, though I did play one route of Saga Scarlet Grace, and I did play all the routes of Frontier Remastered. And so I'm playing the PC demo, which is obviously the access you get as D.Va, who is a mech character. And for me to kind of like clear the cobwebs, you know, knock out the rust, whatever you want to call it, I'm like going through the UI. I'm like looking through the menus, trying to like educate myself what all the icons mean. And then, of course, like with like what James said, not only do you have to say like, okay, my main character is a mech, they work differently. How exactly is that? Let me figure that out. But also you have a beast party member with you, which you talk about, you know, steal enemy abilities. Plus, you've got another character that has a relic like accessory on them, which works differently. And basically, so it's a lot at once. There is a learning curve.
I would even say that you can kind of look at each like part, like demos, like starting setup for what sort of characters they have and get an idea of, okay, so Amaya's probably, well, the PlayStation demo, I think, which is Mito. Since he's mostly just like the main guy and then the Kugutsu, it's like, okay, that's obviously the character that most players should probably start with if they're not familiar with Saga. And then Amaya, where there's like, okay, you have a bit more types like races of characters in your party. Maybe you should play her after you have some experience. And then you look at D.Va and it's like, oh yeah, that's just the party for people that are already Saga sickos. This is for people that already know they're going to be insane. Maybe that's just the vibe I'm getting, but it definitely feels like you can kind of tell how each route is balanced based off of like accessibility for newcomers, just looking at the party makeup at the very start of the route.
So basically, yeah, other routes have training wheels, and that route doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, one specific character I want to talk about is on D.Va's route. Mm-hmm. I wasn't expecting this, and I don't know if it's got a Saga history, so educate me. You have a character named Blythe who is,
plant-like humanoid.
And basically, I noticed, wow, this character is really low LP, and they've got a little plant symbol next to them, and it starts as a sproutling, and then they level up, and it becomes like a plant, and it becomes like a larger plant, and then eventually it's like a wilted plant, and it shows that they have a debuff. They've only got one LP, which means if they die once, they're dead, but they have some sort of inheritance mechanic where they get reborn into like a different version of themselves, or offspring, whatever you want to call it. And so I'm sitting here like, okay, I've got this character that has one LP. Should I deliberately let them die? Like, is this kind of like, I don't know, evolving at some point, like a Pokemon or monster catching game? And like that in addition to having a mech character and a beast character and a character with a relic weapon. So yeah, very much no training wheels here. And then to kind of get to tee up what Josh was talking about in terms of your overworld exploration, and this is how Scarlet Grace worked as well at a high level, is that you might have multiple nodes and the game will tell you this is a side objective, this is a battle objective, this is your main objective. But like you pick one of the side objectives and the game is very transparent about, okay, you pick that side objective. Now we're going to hide the other ones for now because you've picked one. And they might come back once you're done with your current objective, or they might not. Like very clearly, like you made a choice in the PC demo. You're on the, I think they call it Delta Base, and there's like three different divisions, red, yellow, and green, and they're each have a different like research focus, like Josh said. So I went ahead and focused on green, so it hit away like the yellow and red ones. I'm like, all right, I guess I made a choice. I'm going with these guys. Let's see what I get out of it. And you get like gear, you get items, and near the end, I think the ultimate reward I got was like a two-handed ranged weapon that I could equip to the mech. And I'm like, all right, is this good? Is this bad? I don't know. And that's the sort of thing about Saga games, is that a lot of RPGs are kind of conditioned in a way where it's like, oh, don't worry, there's no missables. You can always go back. You know, we'll give you a checklist. We'll give you a progress bar. And Saga's kind of like, maybe. You might have missed something. You might not have. You might have another chance for it. You don't know. And you just kind of have to go with the flow. Which yeah. It's kind of freeing in a way, because in other games, if you miss something, you're almost conditioned to be like, oh crap, my progress bar is going to be always stuck at 95% or whatever, or I'll never have that final accessory. Where in this game, it's just like, don't worry about it. Like, you'll get your chance, or you might not. Just don't worry about it. And it's refreshing and freeing in a way.
Well, also the options are...
We all have opinions. go ahead, Adam. I'll just
These games are sort of meant to be played more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially this one, like... They've outright said, yeah, we've designed it so that playthroughs in this one are shorter than Scarlet Grace, but there's more like permutations of what you can do. So it's very clear that this one explicitly is, you're not going to see everything. There's going to be things that you do where it's like, maybe you do something correctly, but like when you're going through a world in your first playthrough, or maybe you don't, but you can see, oh, I could have done this differently. I wonder what it would have changed.
Yeah, so the interesting part about Emerald Beyond is like after you're in the demo, it's very streamlined. It's very, you know, linear because for demo purposes. But like in the full game, like when you're choosing another world, you have multiple worlds to choose from. And then within that world, like you'll have different events happening depending on like what the choices you make in it. Whether it's like a like different order of like events that you saw, or like you decided to do an event first and then like that maybe locked off another event chain there, but maybe unlock something else in that world, or maybe I don't know for a certain, but maybe it'll like unlock another new event in another world that you may potentially visit. You know, it's sort of like this weird thing where like it's hard to like understand what affects what in Saga, because it's intentionally vague. You know, it's intentionally obscuring like what trigger conditions are in terms of like narrative event flow wise. Because it wants to give you the feeling of discovery again and again and again. And you'll just, like, maybe do, like, a fourth playthrough on, like, Amaya, for example, and you decide to, like, visit, you know, like, the same third world for the, for, like, you know, in this fourth playthrough. And then different events might happen because maybe you'll have a different party composition, and maybe one of your party members in your party composition, like, reacts something to an event that you may have already seen differently, which may trigger another thing that you've never seen before. Just crazy shit like that, potentially, you know? Because that's what's happened before in prior Saga games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you have something to say, Chuck? Because I know you were also...
I was just saying, you know, like, yeah. How, like, about missables. I still get DMs about Trails of Cold Steel. I thought, this trophy didn't pop up. Is this because of this bug? Can you explain it to me? It's like, bro, I haven't played this game in like 3 years. Can you just not tell me about this?
You know? Yeah, please. Saga and Trails are like on YouTube other video ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's funny because like Trails used to be very easily missable, but ever since Cold Steel 3, it's like we're just going to mark everything on the map. Literally everything on the map. If you miss something, it's your own damn fault.
Let's you know, we've been kind of dancing around it, but you know, the main thing that Saga fans were looking forward to with Emerald Beyond is
the soundtrack, which is fucking awesome, baby. Hell yeah.
I mean, yes, it is.
Did you guys hear that D.Va like boss battle theme from the demo? Holy shit. Holy shit.
Yeah. The soundtrack is A+ already in this.
Yeah.
Kenji Ito never misses, okay?
Yeah.
It's very good. But yeah, I mean the battle system, obviously, because if people, you know, listen to us for a long time, a lot of us who played Scarlet Grace, you know, some of us have said it's the best turn-based combat system in an RPG.
It was ever. The best turn-based battle system in a JRPG. I guess since I can talk about the battle system because all the pieces are like in place in the demo, so I can just kind of like go hog wild with this. I didn't expect them to. So like when you look at Emerald Beyond's battle system, and even when you like you just play it with it a little bit, you would immediately think, oh, it's not that big of a difference from Scarlet Grace, but it's surprisingly like they changed up a lot, but it also feels very familiar to the point where I don't know how somebody that's playing Emerald Beyond that hasn't played Scarlet Grace might be able to wrap their head around everything, because it has so much like different systems to consider in the middle of a battle. Like obviously, okay, so let's take a step back here and talk about Scarlet Grace's battle system, because it's kind of like required knowledge to explain what's different about what Emerald Beyond does. To be as simple as possible, the way the battle system in Scarlet Grace worked is that you had a timeline, you had your party members, and you had enemies, and the basics of the combat basically revolved around, okay, if your party was separated and there was like an enemy between them on the timeline, if you killed that enemy so that your entire party connected together or sections of your party connected together, that would lead to a united attack, which not only would mean that each of those party members that got connected would do a follow-up attack on a random enemy, but it also meant that the next turn, their attacks and spells and whatnot, everything, would have a reduced BP cost. That's the basics of it. There are conditionals like, okay, you can have attacks that are interrupts, which make it so that if an enemy's trying to use a specific type of attack, you can interrupt that action and basically hit them earlier. And it also changes your spot in the timeline because it pushes your character to be before them on the timeline because of that interrupt.
Yeah, to provide like context to it is like when it's your turn, it's all round based. So like it's not like when you choose a command for someone, they'll do it immediately. It's like you're tuning your whole entire party's like commands beforehand, and then you like send and say execute, and then the battle will proceed on forward like between what your actions are for your entire party and then the enemy actions.
There's sort of like depending a domino effect, but continue games.
Yeah. But yeah, so then there's like the whole thing where different techs would have different abilities to change your position on the timeline. Some of them might push your character further back. Some of them might push them further forward. Stuff like that. That's about... There's more to it with Scarlet Grace, but I'd say that's the bare essentials that you need to understand to get how Scarlet Grace's battle system works. It's very much timeline manipulation and setting up, like we said, dominoes. And then once the round starts, it's like, if you set it up correctly, you knock over the first domino and then you just wipe the enemy, like the enemies, because you had proper planning to basically make use of the situation that the round gave you. Those same principles mostly exist for Emerald Beyond, and it's very much a battle system that is taking these same core ideas and refining it, but the way that you get to this, the results that you get are a bit different in the sense that instead of united attacks being things that you get as a reward for connecting your party in the middle of a round, like in the middle of combat, it's more like, okay, so if your party members, okay, there's two timelines now. There's a timeline where you and the enemies are actually on it, and then there's also blank spaces on the timeline now. But more importantly, every action that you or enemies can make also leaves these markers underneath the regular timeline that can connect to each other. And if your party members' markers can connect to each other, these green markers connect to each other, then they will do a combo attack, which is like United Attacks from Scarlet Grace, but instead of it being a reward for basically breaking enemies that are like between your two party members, it's just a matter of fact. And the more members in a combo attack and also some other modifiers, for example, like you still get a bonus or a benefit from like killing an enemy to continue a combo attack in this sense, or maybe you have a character do a delay in the middle of a combo attack, which means that another party member is suddenly still part of that chain. You get a bonus for doing that, and it's like an additional combo bonus. Every attack, and including bonuses that is part of that combo attack, will increase the combo rate. And once you hit 150%, there's a chance that some of your party members will do follow-up attacks in what's called overkill. And if you get it to 200%, that's guaranteed. And then just like United Attacks and Scarlet Grace, combo attacks, anyone that participates in a combo will get reduced BP costs for their techs in the next round. But now there's all sorts of other things to consider because the timeline itself is a lot more complicated because it's not just based off of where your units are, but also based off of, okay, what markers do your units' attacks place on the underneath the timeline? Like there's some attacks where markers will be placed just directly underneath the unit, but there might be some that will add markers both before and after them on the timeline. There's just so much. And
as you're describing this, I was trying to think of like, all right, I need to draw like a picture. How, like someone listening to this that doesn't have it in front of them, how do you explain?
Yeah, imagine Avengers is like, what the fuck?
It's understandable.
I think I have a good one. So imagine an Excel spreadsheet, two rows. The top row is your character icons, your chess pieces. The bottom row is like where your ability lands. So column one, your first character might do a slash, and it affects in row two the first three spots. So any other ability that affects those same three spots, that's your combo. And then, of course, that's just two character example, which
well, can be extended not necessarily
to three, four, five.
Not necessarily. It's not any like as long as these markers are connected horizontally, then the combo attack can continue. There's a bit of an extra wrinkle where so the way that interrupts work now is that because it's not just shifting the timeline for the units, but also the markers. You have a case where maybe let's say you have a unit that can't connect to the rest of your party members directly, but there is an enemy that's about to do an attack of a specific attribute right at the end of a combo attack. If you interrupt so that you interrupt that attack, it will continue the combo that way because it will insert a marker right before that enemy attacks. And probably because of the additional combo bonus, you'll get an overkill if you weren't already, and maybe that'll kill them and you might get a vanquish bonus, which means you might get another round of overkill.
I think we're kind of part, like, kind of too deep into the well right now. Like, there's like probably
it's just insane. It's just insane.
Unfollowable for people. But I'll give a better, like, you know, like a clearer picture for, you know, just a very very simple example, like, to kind of correct what like what Brian was saying, because I think Brian has the right idea, but like it's kind of like a very simple example is like, say you have a swordsman who has a skill called Eliminate, and this only affects like one pip of the timeline, right? One section, a segment of the timeline. Then you have another, the werewolf has like a bite attack, and also affects one segment of the timeline. If they're right by each other when these attacks are fire off, that'll execute a unified attack between them because you connected those two small segments together. Of course, if you manage to get other characters like linked to them with similar attacks, you can still, you know, get them incorporated into that united attack. It's a very simple 2-3 person united attack because you linked up their attacks together consecutively on the timeline. There's no blank space in between them for a very basic example.
This is what I intended to say. Yeah. Like what you said is how I understand it. So maybe the word out of my mouth didn't quite.
My picture of it is like was a character who used an attack and does three segments of the timeline. And then I think you were insinuating that the only way to connect the characters was like to land them on those blank spaces.
It can be on or next to.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. Yeah. On or next to.
Yeah, Jason. And then of course, like, as you know, if you're able to follow what Jim's saying, there's all sorts of conditionals that, like, you know, can affect it and like keep a united attack going or expanding it depending on how enemy and character turns are manipulated on that timeline.
Yeah, one thing I will say about a specific conditional that I think is new to Emerald Beyond, I don't think it was in Scarlet Grace, maybe I'm wrong, you have these things called pursuits and chains, and instead of like interrupts where you like basically do an action before a unit, a pursuit directly follows an enemy's action, and a chain directly follows a party member's action. The thing that's interesting about those conditionals is that they add a blank spot in the timeline. They don't leave a marker, but if, let's say, the unit that's right after them has like is using an action that adds an extra marker behind them on the timeline, then if you're doing a pursuit or a chain off of that, then there is a chance that you can actually continue a combo attack off of that if you're smart and you set it up where it's like, okay, I can do this. And even though the timeline doesn't immediately look like you'll be able to like have that combo attack, if you understand what markers you're placing and how the timeline will shift once that pursuit or chain occurs, there's some really interesting like domino effects you can get going with Emerald Beyond. That's like, and then there's like the Showstopper stuff, which is an entirely different thing.
I want to talk about Showstopper. Showstopper is a really funny new mechanic for me in this game. It's one of those, because like there are certain points of the D.Va demo where like you have the option to like do harder encounters. Like, you know, when you go to a combat encounter, it'll actually show the difficulty level of that encounter. Like easy, normal, hard, brutal. Like, so you kind of get a general understanding of like what you might be in for. So like that, there's like these two optional hard fights that I did, and like it took me like quite a bit to like maybe 10 to 15 minutes each, like understand, because this is how I learn battle systems, like more complex battle systems in RPGs. Is like, if you give me a hard encounter in it, I will spend like a lot of time on that harder encounter, even just resetting victories to like better understand how that battle system works. Because that's what, for me, how when the battle system is able to shine, because you have to like make use of all of its systems to be like successful in it. And Snowstopper is an interesting one. We've been talking about like this timeline in this game, and like how there could be like blank spaces, like, you know, during an action turn when like everyone's attacks and actions are firing off, and like, and at certain times, an enemy might have like might be positioned in a timeline where there are no characters or enemies, no characters and enemies like within two segments
on either side
from there. Yeah, on either side. So there's like it's two blank spaces on both the left and right of this enemy.
That includes markers. Like, it's very important. Like, even if you're far, like if you're far enough away from an enemy where that might be a problem, if you have like skills that can reach a marker close enough to them that it breaks that like a blank space on the marker side of things, it can prevent them from doing a showstopper.
Okay, yeah. So that's good info right there, because it's pretty. I was like, oh, okay, that's how that works. So if those conditions are met, this enemy has a chance, it feels like a very high chance, to execute something called a showstopper, and that's basically a super powerful chain of attacks from them, because you left them alone too much in the timeline. So now you're getting punished for that. So you kind of have to also consider that, like, if you're going up against like a really like tough single boss, for example, that does like really hard hitting attacks, then like you have to also consider when you're doing your turn, like, hey, I have to get enemies or their abilities, ranges close to the enemy so they don't trigger a showstopper. And that just adds like another layer of complexity to the time,
yeah, and
the battle system, because you really have to think about your turns.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that the game even points this out, where it's like, yeah, so the more like the less units are on the field, the higher chance that showstoppers will occur on each turn. Which, no shit, because there's less people on the timeline, more open space. It can also be a benefit to you. Like, if you can have it set so that one of your like more powerful units, let's say you do a combo attack with them the turn previously, and then you set them up for a showstopper in the next turn. The way that showstoppers work is like, okay, what if you do a united attack, but instead of it being all the units that you've connected, it's rather, okay, here's one unit, they're just going to fire off all of their skills. And that can be especially powerful for spellcasters, because it'll activate spells without the chance requirement. It'll just instantly do a spell.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's one of those things where it's like, it's another wrinkle to the battle system. And it works for, like you said, the enemies. It can also work for you, but it's a very risk versus reward thing at the end of like tough encounters, where it's like, okay, you might be in a bad situation, but maybe if you set up a showstopper, you can still like win this. But on the same token, you need to be careful to be like, okay, so if you activate a showstopper and leave it so that the enemy can also do a showstopper, if you don't kill them, they're going to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, like in Scarlet Grace, like when you're building up resources to do more skills in a battle, sometimes like it's beneficial to like not even take an action at all in a turn, because if you don't take an action with a person, they'll defend, and actually does significantly reduce damage. So there might be like an opener attack from an enemy that hits AoE, and like it kind of leaves you in a bad spot already. It might be just a good idea to like kind of spend like the first one or two turns just like simply not doing anything at all, and building up resources to counter off counteroffensive. So it's very, very it's up to the player to decide. It's a lot of strategy.
It's very fascinating how some of the changes to the battle system they've made impact stuff that hasn't maybe been changed as much. Like, I'd say that obviously quelling attacks in Scarlet Grace was important, but was one of those things where it wasn't as much a priority as it is in Emerald Beyond because of the way that the united attacks have changed. So it can be a thing where it's like, okay, if you do not quell this attack, you can totally fuck up your combo attack. when one of your units acts. So you might want to immediately, okay, no matter what, you want to make sure that the first attack that goes off, if like you see an enemy like about to like setting up a conditional, it's like, okay, you want to quell this immediately so you don't fuck up any of your combo attacks you're trying to set up, because not only will that impact your game plan for this round, but it's like, okay, if they interrupt this combo attack, that means that it might break this combo, which means that these units won't have access to reduced cost BPs for the next round, which means that your game plan for the next round that you're already planning ahead for might not be viable if you don't like solve this right now. It's just Scarlet Grace's battle system was already incredible for how it really made you think about the timeline on a meta sense. I'm shocked at how much more they added to it in Emerald Beyond without it. It sounds overwhelming talking about it, but especially if you already had familiarity with Scarlet Grace and you sit down and mess with Emerald Beyond for a little bit, it is surprising how, despite how different it is in application in some ways, it clicks really quickly.
Yeah, at least for me. I was able to, like, you know, it took me like maybe like an hour of like hard fights to like wrap my head around, but I think I got like the gist of like most of its like fundamentals down. But that's also because, you know, I've also not recently, but I've played Scarlet Grace before, so I'm really interested to see like how newcomers adapt it, because I think the misconception about the game from newcomers is like, oh, it's just like I just link these attacks the green bar together between party members, and it's like I automatically win. That's all you have to do, and I think that's gonna be a common misconception on this game. That's like, that's the only strategy layer for it. And I think there's a lot more going on underneath the hood, and I think that will rear its head more at the latter stretch of playthroughs, of like when there are going to be more tricky enemies to really push you into like to really push you out of that mentality, saying, hey, sometimes you don't want to like do extended united attacks after an enemy turn, because the enemy turn might like just disrupt your whole entire domino effect entirely and like leave you vulnerable, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Ignoring like the caveats and like the special like interrupts, pursuits, chases, just in general at a very high level, 101, like if you're trying to bundle together your markers and your action pips so that you and are initiating a combo, what that means is if there's like three or four enemies on the field, if you're bundling your icons together, chances are their icons are being bundled together too, and they're going to combo back. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword where it's like, I could have these four characters combo, or I can keep this fourth character in between the enemies so they don't combo.
Right.
You know, basically there's always that plug and play, or I almost said plug and play, basically just like double-edged sword where you have to, you know, decide, I could make my combo stronger, and maybe if I do that, then the enemy will be eliminated, and whether or not they're going to try to combo doesn't matter. Or I know they're not going to be eliminated, I don't want them to combo, so I'll weaken mine in order to prevent them from doing theirs.
Yeah, see,
I don't know if it's going to turn out good or not until you try it.
I guess an important thing to mention is, like, all these mechanics that we're talking about, like united attacks and, like, pursuits and chains, that's a two-way street. It's not just you, these aren't exclusive abilities for you. The enemy has access to that and will do it against you as well. So
I think my favorite was playing in Scarlet Grace, where the AI killed, or like the boss killed one of my characters, and then the timeline just all lined up, causing this domino effect to like kill them, because all the combos start linking because they killed one of my characters.
Funny. Yeah. And yeah, sometimes it just works in your favor like that, you know? Sometimes it's just how it works.
Yeah, it's like I was talking with someone else playing the demo the other day, and like I think the way I described it is that Saga Scarlet Grace and Emerald Beyond specifically are for the types of people where if a domino chain like wipes their entire party in a single round, they just like kind of kick their legs and giggle like a little kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we say it jokingly a lot, but it is definitely. With Emerald Beyond and Scarlet Grace before, it's like it is. These are games for turn-based sickos, like for people who really, really want to see how versatile and flexible a turn-based battle system is in an RPG. These are some of like the go-to games because they offer so much freedom in how you approach battles and that aren't really seen in other RPGs at all. Because in other RPGs, you usually have the, you know, your 3 to 4 party members lined up in a row, you know, and doing their actions individually from one another. And they do have, like, you know, their own mechanics as well. But there's, like, really for
I think
different approach to most RPGs.
I can't speak for everyone, but I feel like it was probably a fairly common concern after Scarlet Grace to wonder, okay, so how are they going to like expand on that? Because with how like balanced Scarlet Grace's battle system was, I was worried that anything they added to it might throw the balance off like off completely. But ironically enough, with such wide sweeping changes they made to Emerald Beyond, it's insane. And really, not enough can be said about the fact that they still kept the main vibes of the Scarlet Grace battle system, despite the fact that on paper, and once you're actually like, you actually break it down, it's like, oh no, this is like entirely different, except for like one or two things that you can point to and be like, yeah, that this was based off that.
Yeah. You know, I think they really made some really interesting evolutions to that philosophy behind Scarlet Grace. It's not a one-to-one like improvement, but it's a different it expands upon it in really smart ways. There are some things that Emerald Beyond does better, there are some things Scarlet Grace does better in their battle system, but both of them are still very, very cool in the way that they tackle. I'm very excited to see like what the full game has, because you know, you'll have more access to more formations, more different party members. You know, like on top of all what we're saying about the battle system, this is also layering on top of like all the things that we were saying before, like different like capabilities of like how you quote unquote improve or level up or enhance different races of your party members, you know, because those can all be quite different as well. So it's gonna be a lot to take in.
One small thing that took me like 20 minutes to kind of figure out is that when you're highlighting over your gear, there's like three different places where it can show like an inherent bonus that it gives. It can show you whether or not it improves like your evade or block percent. And then it showed like this icon that looked like a microchip. And I'm like, what is that? Oh, that's the ability that a for mech techs. Would get if they equip this as armor. But it's D.Va, the way that their story is set up is that they have limited equipment slots starting out. So they only have weapons equipped, and all the other slots, like where you would normally equip armor or accessories, are blocked. So I didn't have any armor equipped, so I didn't know that that's how it worked until I kind of looked at, I have this broadsword equipped, but because I'm a mech, I don't get its normal ability. I get this other ability listed. And then even on like the retinue screen, the party screen, the amount of skills for a mech is much lower because it doesn't have broadsword, dagger, or sorry, one-handed sword, two-handed sword, axes. It just shows melee mech or ranged mech, because it's they kind of treat it all as like a universal thing that they can equip regardless of whether or not it's a broadsword or a rapier. So basically, yeah. Like there's little nuggets like that all throughout the game where, oh, this one thing for this one character or this one piece of gear works slightly differently, but usually the UI is, it's pretty cluttered. It takes a little bit, and I don't want to say cluttered,
it's not like the most obvious like intuitive layout for like where you want info to like be highlighted, you know. It does take some finagling and to kind of understand, and it's hard to say. It's like, well, what would be my solution? It's like, I don't know if I have like an alternative, like good alternative solution as well either.
It reminds me a little bit of it's a very, very, very different game, but like I remember when Xenoblade 2 came out, combat UI there. It's like, what is this spaghetti mess?
Didn't you write a guide on like how the Xenoblade 2 battle system worked? And like that was like one of the most popular baby changes at that time.
Yeah. And it's like, you play the game and eventually you're like, no, everything here makes sense and have a spot. And I assume, I almost want to say like Scarlet Beyond. No, Emerald Beyond. Scarlet Grace, Emerald Beyond. I think you put a little time into it, you learn it, and then you kind of learn where to find everything. Okay, this is where I find character skills. Okay, this is where I can learn what rank their abilities are. And you just kind of have to learn to navigate it. And everything does have a spot, and there are like cool tips on basically everything. And then break glass in case of emergency, there is like a tips and glossary section. If you're not sure, like, what does acuity actually improve? You can go in and read it. It's like, oh, it's the best analog would say like magic defense, but
yeah,
you know,
so what I'm hearing, go for it.
I was going to say, it's time for Brian to write Unlimited Saga Battle System Explained.
I was actually going to do that. I was about to say, hey, Brian, so you're saying that you're going to write a 10,000-word essay on how Emerald Beyond's battle system works, right?
No, I should. But it's really funny, speaking about Unlimited Saga, it's like, can we just talk about how, like, it's been really refreshing to see such, like, the way that they've handled the English PR for Emerald Beyond is really refreshing, because you got Neil over at Square Enix and they're basically just like having a direct, like, look, we know that the Saga fan base isn't huge in the West, but we also know that you're probably going to actually engage with us in good faith. So it's like, it's really been fascinating seeing the way that they've like directly reached out to people in that community and the way that they've tried to connect to people. It's like, and it's funny how they're, how like Kawazu outright asked, or, well, I think it was either Kawazu or Neil, or it was like, there was a Twitter poll where it's like, hey, so if we did an Unlimited Saga remaster, would you prefer if what sort of changes would you want or not want? And pretty much everyone's like, just add better tutorials, change nothing else.
Okay. I mean, that'd be great, actually. That'd be like,
yeah.
That, I could see that actually working, to be honest.
I also just want to show appreciation that the localization director, Neil, like, this isn't just any localization guy. Like, this is a person who, like, knows his Saga. Like, he's been Saga-pilled. He knows what he's talking about. We connect. So,
yeah, it's really cool to see, like, how much, like, Neil's, like just directly engaged, like, with fans, like, on social media. Like, if they have any questions, he'll just flat out answer them. Like, this is how we got info of, like, hey, like, save data transfer from the demo into the full game. It's like, it was kind of weird because we didn't know this until, like, the day of when Square Enix finally released PR, but, like, before that, when we were reporting on it, it's like, where was this confirmed? It's like, oh, it's because Neil, like, just directly answered one of the people asking on Twitter, you know? It's like, okay, cool. I think it's a Saga community, always lovely, you know, and it's really cool to see, like, Neil and Kawazu and the development team just, like, kind of convey more info directly with, like, kind of, like, their mini gameplay showcases that sometimes pops up on the Saga and the Square Enix YouTube channel, just saying, hey, you know, or just chilling, showing out more of the game, explaining more of the things that, like, you know, we want you to know about this game, and, you know, just a fun time.
It's funny how they've been doing these, like, separate little character snippets, and, like, in the end of one of the more recent ones, I was like, next time on Saga Emerald Beyond, and they're, like, tying into, like, Bonnie for me, it's like, get down, Mr. President!
Nice.
So good.
Yeah. So, the Saga Emerald Beyond demo is, you know, it's available now for the PlayStation 5 and 4, Nintendo Switch, and PC via Steam, and, you know, like,
the Saga Emerald Beyond demos. Each one has a separate playable character, so they are distinct demos, technically.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I still don't know what version to pick, so I'm just kind of, like, waiting for the full release.
So here's the thing. Like, for the PlayStation demo for this is Mido, but the kind of, like, the quote-unquote main character guy who uses all the Kogutsu puppets. If it's your first Saga, this is probably the route to kind of try and see, because they'll probably have, like, the most kind of, like...
Assuming you own a PlayStation.
Yeah, I mean, like, even with the full game, like, when you get the full game, you can, like, have access to all the routes, obviously. But if you have, you know, if you have a PlayStation, go download that. For the Switch demo of Emerald Beyond, you have Emilia the Witch. Once again, I wouldn't say it's too complicated. She does have, like, interesting limits, because, like, she has mainly feline party members. So they have kind of interesting quirks. But, like, you know, I wouldn't say the average difficulty level for Emilia doesn't seem too crazy. And then if you're on Steam, you have access to Diva number 5 for the Saga Emerald Beyond demo.
PC players, you're being typecast. They expect you to understand what you're doing, which, fair enough if you're playing RPGs on PC. So,
yeah.
So what you're saying is PlayStation fans are normies, then.
Yes.
RIP.
Why would someone take that completely out of context?
No, not normies. Ah! But yeah, I mean, it's one hell of a demo. They also released, you know, some more new trailers with, like, the D.Va character trailer and the final trailer for Saga Emerald Beyond, because the release date for this is just a few weeks out, so it's almost there. And then we also put up a lot of, like, info for the D.Va number 5's route, like the other character routes, like, kind of, you know, showing off more of her story, the characters involved. and all that good stuff. And it's looking to be one hell of a game. Like, this demo is already pretty beefy, and it's just like, it's only going to get more and more complex.
Yep.
The second game we're going to talk about today is a game that I've seen get a little bit of word of mouth in Discord channels and social media that I don't know actually when it released, so I'm going to rely on two of our participants here to kind of team me up. It's a game called Felvedek. So I'm going to start out with Josh. My understanding, which might be incorrect, is that this is an indie RPG that recently released on Steam.
Yeah.
And it kind of... I'll just leave it at that. So what in the world is Felvedek, and why are people talking about it?
So Felvedek recently came out at the very end of March. It is made by largely a solo development effort. I think there was some, you know, obviously external help by an individual named Joseph Pavelka. And it is an RPG set in the 15th century Slovakia. Go for it, James.
By the developer's own description, and if you play it for a little bit, it makes perfect sense why he described it that way. It's like, what if we made a JRPG that is set in the Middle Ages for Slovakia? And by that, specifically, it's Dragon Quest. It's Dragon Quest.
it's made in RPG Maker, but has a very, very distinct look. I don't even know how to describe the look of it, to be honest. I lack the technical
one
term,
second. Like, one sec. Let me get some screenshots to post in the voice channel, because it is very much like the art style. The best way to describe it is just to post like a picture. It's like, it is very much like evoking some of those old school PC RPGs with regards to the art style, but it's like very much kind of like a painted over with pixel art.
Almost like rotoscoped, low poly polygonal.
Well, I believe that's actually what happened. Like, the developer actually had a Twitter GIF on his account showing how he designed the art. Very much was it was hand drawn, and then it was filtered over for the pixel art, and it was like a very interesting process. But anyways, this is what Felvedek looks like.
Yeah, and for people listening, you know, I highly recommend going to the Felvedek Steam page. That's Felvidek. Go to the Steam page for it, because, you know, words can't possibly describe how this game looks. I lack the technical capability, but like, it's a pretty, it's a very, very, very visually distinct, like JRPG styled game. And when you go into combat encounters, it's very much like that Dragon Quest first person. Your character is facing against the enemies. You only see the enemy models, and you're facing directly to you. And every time you do an action, like an attack, casting a spell, items, there's like a custom animation that that animates as if like you're doing this in first person. So like when you're swinging a sword, you kind of see like the hand motions. You see the sword, and you just see it slash like in first person. It looks really, really, really cool in motion. And the script for this game is
excellent.
Fantastic.
Localization. Excellent localization. It is really, really funny. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's
ye old English. A lot of ye old English.
With random Slovakian like thrown in there too, just because mm-hmm. like in the middle of sentences and places where it makes sense. It's like it's kind of really hard to describe this without spoiling what makes it like so interesting, besides the fact just saying it's like it's a Dragon Quest styled game where the setting is the Middle Ages with a very painterly pixel art style with a hilarious script, but also that takes itself seriously enough. It's not very long. It's like 4 to 5 hours. It's like $11. It's like, it's definitely one of those like indie RPGs that I feel like people are especially going to be talking about come the end of the year. Like it's just really neat.
It's really interesting too, because like combat encounters, like they don't fuck around with combat in this game. Like it does, like you really have to strategize, especially early on, like how you're doing combat encounters, because enemies aren't pushovers. They do a lot of damage. You have very limited resources in battle, like how to recover, how to mitigate damage. And the interesting part is, like, enemies don't respawn in this game. There's no random encounters. You run into them on the map, and when you finish an enemy, they're gone completely from the game permanently. So you can't. There's not like any grinding that you can do. So it's worth checking out. Like, obviously it's hard to talk about because like the runtime of the game, as James mentioned, it doesn't take that long, but it has, you know, a really interesting story. It's pretty, very humorous, with really interesting, stupid characters. And I just, you know, whenever you have like some time and some spare cash to kind of give this game a shot. I think it's only available on PC. I don't know if it's coming to other platforms, but you know, the if you have any, is Steam Deck compatible, James? I imagine it's just run on Steam Deck.
I haven't tried it on there yet, but I've seen people say that it works just fine, which it's an RPG Maker game, of course, so it runs just fine.
Yeah, and the system requirements for this game is like any fucking
your PC run will run it.
Yes, your PC will run it, guaranteed. So it's awesome. I really like it a lot.
Yep. I guess it's really funny how, like, and I kind of wish I had talked about some other, like, indie RPGs I'd played, like, over the last couple of months or, like late last year, but it's really one of those things where, and the way I discovered this is I literally was like, let me check out my Steam Discovery queue, because sometimes I check that and it'll show you stuff that's just come out or maybe is suddenly popular, and it's a really interesting tool for figuring out games that maybe you wouldn't have heard of otherwise. And, like, especially for RPGs, it is shocking just how much stuff comes out on PC, releases either on Steam or itch.io, and you just don't really hear about it because it releases, maybe it starts blowing up. Like Felvedeck, it seems like more people are talking about it. I feel like that's one of those sorts of RPGs where give it a couple of months, it'll be a surprising success. But there's stuff all the time that releases that's really cool. And if you have, and most of the time, these RPGs will run on pretty much any system. So, like, if you play on PC or if you have a PC that can even moderately play games, sometimes it's worth it just to, like, look through Steam. Maybe you'll find something neat. Like, I won't talk about it here, but, like, there was, like, this one game I played, like, last year, Kowloon's Curse Lost Report, which is a standalone prologue to a larger, like, RPG project the developer's making that's really, really neat. And that one's completely free. Completely free. It's, like, 3 to 4 hours. Really cool time. It's, like, yeah, especially if you're on a budget and you just want to try something new, like it literally cannot hurt just to take a look at what you might be able to find on like Steam or itch.
Yeah, like this game has brought to attention. I think one of my friends like saw it at like a Steam Next Fest demo and just kind of linked the Steam page on Steam. I'm like, damn, this looks really fucking cool.
And I have my issues with Valve, but Steam Next Fest is perfect for that sort of thing.
Yeah. And also, the music in this game is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
So, and for people who know Hylix, this game was inspired by Hylix. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a damn cool game. Definitely, yeah, give it a shot whenever. Yeah.
And the last game that I've listed here, that I believe is a James entry, is Puyo Puyo Puzzle Pop.
I think
I've seen you tweet about this.
Yeah, I played another Apple Arcade exclusive.
Mainline Puyo Puyo game, huh?
Yeah, mainline Puyo Puyo. I am not as much of a Puyo expert as some people on my timeline, but according to people that are, this game has a lore, like story critical lore that is being expanded upon that hasn't been touched on in 2 decades.
Okay.
So this is a mainline Puyo Puyo game.
So what like, modes does it have? So, you know, but people think about Puyo Puyo, they think about like the arcade game, they think about like, you know, the head-to-head competition, the Puyo Puyo games.
It has everything you would want. It has the different styles of play. It obviously has Puyo Puyo 2, it has Puyo Puyo Fever, it has Mini, it has like literally all the Puyo Puyo modes that were in like Puyo Puyo Tetris 2 are in here.
Okay.
Every single one. There's a story mode. It's not finished yet, but I think that's an Apple Arcade thing where like Apple just wants you to like say, oh, we can have an update like a couple of months down the line because they want people to stay sub to Apple Arcade. I've noticed this as a trend that sometimes some games will literally just release part of the game and then like a few months later they'll release the rest of it. Like Fantasian did it with part one and part two. It seems like for the story mode and Puzzle Pop, that's what they're also doing this time around, where it's like, okay, here's the first half of the story, and I assume the second half will drop later this year, whether that's the summer or the fall, I don't know. But what's there now is pretty interesting because it's like stage based. There's like a world map. There's different challenges. There's different like story nodes where you can fight, like go up against characters. There's different like objectives to get certain amount of stars. Like some.
It's not selectable characters, right? That have like their own different quirks of like how they kind of push trash to the other field.
Oh no! This isn't Puyo Puyo Chronicle. It just uses the models. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, but the story actually has some meat to it. There's like branching paths for optional like challenges. Like there's like this game, and this is really funny since it's the Apple Arcade exclusive, probably does the best job at teaching new players how to actually play Puyo Puyo. Like the tutorial is really good, and I posted like some screenshots on my Twitter where it's like, yeah, it teaches you how to do stairs, it teaches you how to do sandwiches, it teaches you how to do turnarounds. It teaches you how to continue chains. It teaches you, okay, so here's what you want to do in order to make sure your chains will, like, it's insane. Because, like, I feel like the one main problem that Puyo Puyo has is that people are so intimidated about it because it's different from traditional. Well, not traditional, because Puyo Puyo is a traditional party game, puzzle game. But it's, like, it feels like a lot of people are scared of getting into Puyo Puyo because there's so much nuances to how you play it. And most Puyo games, or I guess Puyo Puyo Tetris, doesn't do a good enough job to teach you how to actually play Puyo on a like on a macro scale. This teaches you how to do it, and like the way the tutorials work is it's not just like, okay, here's some text about how to do. It will literally give you an example as they build up the chains. Like, here's how it looks as you're building it up, and here's what you want to do to set it off. Here's how it's. It's insane that it took them this long, but they finally did it.
Yeah. Time is the best remedy or something like that.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like it has everything you'd want. It has all these little side modes. It has like challenge mode where it like gives you these challenges. It's like it gives you a certain number of Puyo sets to be like, okay, so here's your sets. Here's what we want you to do. Do it.
Like, here's like a pre. Does it support the head-to-head online multiplayer?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, it has ranked matches. It has casual matches. It has rooms. Like I said, this is a mainline Puyo Puyo game. Literally everything you would expect from a mainline Puyo, it's here.
A little backstory is, you know how I met James is through a Puyo versus Tetris match.
Really?
That's funny. Yeah, I remember when Puyo Puyo Tetris came out on Switch. I believe we actually played the original, like on that. That's how we did, like on this one Discord server, I believe.
I was like, "Paying," was like, "Hey, I just bought this game." He's like, "I want to play against somebody." Does anyone want to play it? James like, "Oh, I'm up for it." That's how I met James.
Yeah. I forget how that went. Did you kick my ass, or was it the other way around?
I kick your ass if it's on Puyo, but if you switch to Tetris mode, I can't win.
Oh, yeah, the T-spins. But,
I think those games always have, like, a design issue where, like, Tetris players, if they're really good at it, the Puyo players cannot stand a chance against them, or something like that.
Yeah, that's why I was always a big fan of Swap as a game mode, because it forces you to be competent at both.
Because oh, yeah, Swap is really fun in Puyo Puyo Tetris. Yeah.
But, not much else to say. It's a Puyo Puyo game. It's really good. It's a mainline entry.
It's Apple Arcade exclusive.
Yeah. Good news is that Midori, noted Sega Atlas leaker, has also said, there is a console game coming. Don't worry.
So. Okay, well, hopefully, yeah. I was about to ask, like, okay, so how long does this is this not an Apple Arcade exclusive anymore?
Yeah.
So hopefully that is it. It's just like the full thing with no story update to like wait for, and it's just like it's there with more features.
Yeah, it would suck. Awesome. It would suck if the console Puyo game was entirely different. Just because if this is a mainline, that means like considering Sega's track record, once this gets delisted, it's like, well, that's just a whole mainline Puyo game that becomes lost media.
They have. I really wonder what their contract with Apple Arcade is, because Sega seems to have a really interesting one.
Yeah, it sounds like their relationship is strong, and there was like all this noise about how like Apple is trying to soft relaunch Apple Arcade, and it seems like Sega is a major part of that. So, who knows?
And that covers us for the game. Oops, sorry. Was that any other final concluding?
No, I was just going to say it's Puyo Puyo. That's basically it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of covers us for games we've been playing. Of course, as you can tell by the discussion here, we're all very much looking forward to Saga Emerald Beyond, one of only a handful of games releasing at the end of the month. We do have a fairly good slate of news posts here. But before we go into that, we do have a belated review going up on the site for one of the March releases. Early in March, of course, we saw the release of Unicorn Overlord. We did have a discussion of that on the podcast, but we didn't have a written review up at the time. Our reviewer was just tackling multiple things around the time that it came out. As you all know, it's been a busy time of year, but we do have the Unicorn Overlord review up on the site over at rpgsite.net. So Colin put that together for us. So do go check it out. And I know a few of us have been continuing to play that into April.
I'm finally circling back around to it. So I've just been kind of making my way through it because I was busy with all the other games that came out.
Yeah, and I think I finished it like 2 weeks ago. But of course, we were talking about a lot of other releases on the podcast at that time. So we'll definitely kind of circle the wagons on that as we get towards the end of the year to see all the different opinions on it. Our first headline here that we have listed this week is actually more of a kind of like a business-focused headline rather than like a new game announcement or trailer or date. But of course, the business in question is Square Enix, which is makes up by like the plurality of our coverage over at RPGsite.net. On April 1st, Takashi Kiryu, boss man over at Square Enix, put out a newsletter on the Japanese-facing website for Square Enix about the list of current and new executive officers over at Square Enix. So a lot of the obviously existing executive officers, their names remain on the list, such as Yoshinori Kitase, Naoki Yoshida, etc. So more interestingly, we do have a list of new names, so basically effectively Square Enix directors, producers that have been effectively promoted or placed onto their executive leadership. There's a handful of names here. Some of the ones that are a little bit more interesting when I'm reading through the list is Tomoya Asano of Team Asano. So, of course, we had Octopath Traveler 2 last year. And then Naoki Hamaguchi, the director of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, is also on the executive officer list here. We also do have the inclusion of Takamasa Shiba, Takeshi Nozue, and Takayuki Hamada. Those three I'm not as familiar on. I'd have to check on those. But just kind of an interesting kind of shakeup in terms of the leadership over at Square Enix.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, like, I believe Nozue has just been a general manager on, like, a lot of, like, recent Square Enix stuff, Rebirth, Foam Stars, FF16, and Final Bar Line. And Shiba, I also was a producer on, like, Dio Field, I believe.
Oh, yeah, Dio Field Sweep.
There you go. Yeah, finally, getting the recognition. I'm not too sure about Hamada off the top of my head. But, you know, it's kind of like, obviously for the public, it's good to see, like, Hamaguchi's, you know, promotion here because a lot of people felt very strongly.
I think that's the most well-deserved promotion, I would say.
So, you know, all these have already gone under effect as of April 1st. I think, aside from these promotions, I think the bigger story that came out of here was broken by Bloomberg, I believe, Adam, on Dragon Quest series executive producer Yumiake stepping down from that position and has gone to oversee Square Enix's mobile division, I believe.
That's according to the Bloomberg reporting. So Square Enix's mobile revenues have been stagnant or dropping for a while now, and you've seen several of their games get announced and then shut down, stuff like the Bravely Default mobile game, the Echoes of Mana, I think it was, mobile game, and things like that. And the Nier mobile game just is about to or just recently shut down. And
The Dragon Quest TAC, I think.
Yeah, and like they only have like four or five mobile games currently running, I think. They have like Brave Exvius, they have Ever Crisis, they have Romantic Saga, Octopath, and I might be missing one.
I think that's in the West because I know they have a few more in Japan.
They shut down the Full Metal Alchemist one, I think. But
yeah, they did.
Anyways, people reporting on this about like this movement of Yu Miyake to the smartphone division, it's kind of weird to me in that people there's like this implication that it's like a demotion or like a punishment. Like Dragon Quest XII has been delayed, so now you have to go do mobile games or something. And it's kind of weird to me. Like they're moving this guy to mobile games because they need to have a shakeup in their mobile game division too, because it hasn't been where they want it to be. So it's also just as likely that they're moving Yu Miyake to this position because they trust him to turn it around.
This guy has been at the company for many years and like has
1992
produced some of like
or something like that. So
yeah, it's some of their biggest, most profitable games. So like, of course, they would want a trusted head, you know, to oversee one of their most important, segments of the business.
Yeah, to be clear, like Square Enix's entertainment segment of their business, it's split up into three categories. There's like HD games, which are like console games. There's MMOs, and then there's like mobile browser, and that section is pretty significant. So
yeah.
Actually, let me check something here. Give me a second.
Yeah, and the Bloomberg article does mention they believe that Yosuke Saito, who is best known for role as producer of the Nier series, might take over Miyake's role of like series producer for the Dragon Quest. That's not confirmed. That's just Bloomberg's. That's what they believe is going to be the case based on their source.
Yeah, we should probably be clear that all of this is reported by Bloomberg, so it's not like technically official, but it's about as close to it as you can get without being official, because Bloomberg's usually not wrong. So
they're usually very thorough about that, you know, their sourcing and reporting, more so than like other places. Like they have a prestige for a reason on that front.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at Square Enix's digital entertainment section. If you're just counting sales, not necessarily revenue, and the way that Square Enix labels these is actually intentionally vague a little bit, but if you just go by sales, their smart device PC browser like section, which is one of the three, is slightly less than half relating to MMO and HD games. My point is that it's a significant chunk. Like it's being head of the smartphone division isn't a demotion. It is. They need someone.
That segment alone almost consists of 50%, while the other two, other two segments, have to like work together to make up that other part of the equation as well. So, yeah, the mobile division, you know, definitely pulls its weight, and without it, Square Enix would not be in a great position at all. So, yeah. So it's just one of those things that like Adam and I noticed when reporting on this came out in the West. It's like that's kind of a weird. It's a weird framing of like he's getting quote unquote demoted because of the delays in Dragon Quest XII's development, which is that doesn't really add up. that it's a weird narrative.
The one that comes from mobile games.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
It really just kind of boils down to like we don't know. We know he was moved. Speculate beyond that. Everything past that is speculation.
So also this April 1st is the start of the fiscal year for a lot of Japanese companies, almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them. And so a lot of these sorts of corporate restructures or things like that usually happen this month. And starting at the end of April and for Square Enix, the beginning of May, that's when we start to get the the full year fiscal results. And Square Enix's this year, we'll get this in early May, is going to be really interesting because they have the new president. He has explicitly said they're doing this reorganization. Now, this reorganization is basically currently underway, and that's why Bloomberg got, you know, has sources to hear of it. But it will be hopefully officially announced and hopefully officially detailed, clarifications and details and whatnot, in about a month. And then, of course, there's other things like, how well did Final Fantasy VII Rebirth do? I don't know. Exactly. They haven't said anything yet.
They have to mention that in their upcoming. Yeah, that's what
they literally said quite explicitly at the end of their half year mark, the last fiscal year, that this fiscal year that just ended basically hinges on how well Rebirth did. Like they're putting, it's kind of like all their hopes and dreams on this game. So obviously it critically did well, but we'll see commercially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's pretty clear that since they haven't said anything about the sales and we were hearing that there was a big restructure, that kind of says it all, really.
It's hard to be optimistic.
The sales figures that they provide will be very interesting.
I think there's just too many things stacked against it. Like, first you have to play the first part of the remake. It's a PS5 exclusive. And then there's some people that are annoyed about the first part of the remake. There's so many things are stacked against it.
But and really big shakeups over there at Square Enix, and we'll see what they have to say when that report comes out. It's going to be probably one of the more important reports coming out for this company.
Yep.
And then in terms of game announcements for this week, the first one we have is a new IP from Savage Level and publisher Microids. I've not heard of each of these, but the game is interesting. It's called Flint Treasure of Oblivion. It is an isometric turn-based, so think Baldur's Gate 3 contemporarily, game that has like a pirate theme to it. So it's like when I look at the artwork, if you look at the both the 2D artwork of the key art as well as in-game, it has like a very like Pirates of the Caribbean sort of feel to it. And it's slated to come out this year in Q4 for Xbox, PlayStation, and PC. And it's the debut title for Savage Level, built on Unreal Engine 5. So, I don't know. It seems like an interesting project. Like, it's been a while since I've played like a seafaring pirate, you know, nautical themed RPG like this. I guess the most natural point of comparison in my head is like Pillars of Eternity, Deadfire.
Hexagonal grids for its combat, which is fun. You don't really see hexagon grids that much anymore in games.
I've seen a few games talk, like, what was it? Lost Soul Aside that had hexagonal grids or something? No, like
Lost Soul Aside has the action RPG. The one that was like the remake of that one PS1 RPG that's slipping my head that had hexagon grids.
To me, like, one's not inherently better than the other. Like, ours is, you know, we've got two extra directions you can go. Ooh, and I'm just like, oh, okay. Like, whatever. Like, it doesn't register, like, whether it's hexagonal or... But I'm sure, you know, they obviously had an intent and a concept when they were designing the game that they decided to go with hexagonal. But yeah, the most of the debut announcement trailer for this is, like, comic book style CG art. There's only a very few small snippets of gameplay. But it's got, the decent art style, isometric viewpoint to it. Lots of, like, smoke effects and kind of, like, a muted color palette.
It is an interesting stylistic decision because, like, the delivered narrative segments and scenes in this game, obviously, like, you know, this team is, still fairly new, going to be their first project. And, like, they understand, like, there's, like, obviously going to be restraints and, like, their know-how and development, so like to deliver like narrative scenes, they're using like comic book paneling for them, which is really cool. Like these story scenes are like kind of like delivered like in a comic book. That's good. I'm really interested to see how this game does. I think there's a really cool, ambitious thing to have as like your first game.
And the other major news this week is the announcement on the Japan side of things of what is effectively Disgaea 7 Complete. The Japanese translation translates more to something, at least according to Kite, who covered this news, Disgaea 7 with a subtitle that translates to "We've started inserting everything up to now." So I actually didn't know if this.
That better be what the English title is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just like, so I've always known them as Disgaea whatever Complete, and it always comes out a year and a half or so after the main game. But yeah, Makai Senkei Disgaea 7, Koromare no Zenbu Urai Hajime Mashita.
Well, in previous entries were kind of different, at least in the West, because usually when they did the complete version, it was also a port to other platforms. Six especially, okay. Six's exclusivity was weird, but... and we talked about that, but this game was sort of
only a thing in the West too.
Exactly. So. Yeah. But this game is a little bit different in that it basically was multi-platform PC, Switch, PlayStation, day and date with everything. And now it's like, okay, here's just a new version on all of those platforms, I guess. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there's the whole thing where, like, I think this is going to sound maybe a bit weird, but I kind of preferred back with like the Sky 3 and 4 where when they made those ports and that added extra content, they also changed the subtitle. And I kind of hope this means that the Sky 7 is doing the same thing with its update, because just having it be the subtitle complete, it's descriptive, but it feels a bit boring. And for a series like the Sky, that it feels like the character is lost. And maybe that doesn't make sense.
I mean, to me, it's just like, it's a title. Yeah. I'm more concerned with the meat of the game. But it's going to be weird because it's like, if they're doing this as a separate thing, they're going to have like the base game, and then there's going to be a new version, and that's going to have complete. So, like, will this just have like a different page on Steam if it comes west, and it comes to PC? Will it just have like be like, here's this Gaia 7, but with all the DLC plus this new Asagi content exclusive to it? And then so there's no reason to get the old one unless it's at a cheaper price, but then you have all that DLC still. Like, I don't know if they do that on Steam, where they like kind of sell a second version of the game, but it just has all the DLC bundled in it already. I don't think so. So
did anyone here play the base this guy 7?
No, I didn't have time, and apparently waiting paid off.
Yeah, so. I hear it's really good. I hear it's really good. I played a bit of it at a preview thing at NIS America's headquarters last year. I have not played the full release. I don't know when I'll play the full release, because I'm one of those sickos that's like, I want to play the Sky 1 through 6 first.
So. Good luck. Yeah, yeah, you and Adam both.
And I don't remember if I said this, Japanese release for consoles on July 27th has not been officially announced for localization.
July 25th.
Oh, sorry, 25th. My bad. I saw my eyeballs saw 25th, and then my brain decided to say 27th. A few updates for some recently announced games. Of course, this summer we have the upcoming multi-platform release of Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance. When that game was announced, we already talked about in a couple different contexts on the podcast what it includes, including new content. It has all the old DLC wrapped into it. It's going to get new DLC. And Atlus released a new trailer for the upcoming re-release, remaster, whatever you want to call it. And the main thing here is that it showcases a new form for the Nahobino that looks, I don't know, like the Power Ranger, White Ranger sort of thing. That's what I think of when I see this. And it shows a little bit of gameplay that indicates potentially the presence of some more traditional like dungeon exploration with some, it looks kind of like the little clip that we have, like the character changes which part of the field they're exploring on, like a reverse gravity sort of thing. It's hard to say based on just like 20 seconds of footage, but I know that was considered a main criticism of Shin Megami Tensei V, is that it really only had like 1.25 dungeons. So
yeah, and one of them got like quote unquote nerfed because that was apparently too difficult for people. So I was like, okay, I guess. So yeah, it's nice to see, like, you know, this kind of looks a little bit like the Labyrinth of Obala from SMT3 Nocturne. Like just having like the new expanded content has like a big dungeon aspect to some part of it. As you mentioned, like the obviously the big surprise in this new trailer is like the Nahobino like has like, so I guess they're sort of alluding to it with this trailer where you kind of have this battle against this new Kaditsu faction. So you have all the four main new demons like in that fight, and maybe it's I don't know how it's going to shake out, but like apparently maybe as sort of a result of that fight, like the main form that we all know of the Nahobino is like sort of like shattered or sort of broken. So they somehow gain a new form as a result. And it's a really interesting design mix up because it looks to be like a more agile like assassin ninja form for it. Like even like the weapon for it isn't conventional at all. It's not like the laser blade with the original Nahobino form. It's like kind of like a curved sort of like hook aspect to it, and it looks to be more agile. And like the one skill that they showed off for it in battle here, it has like an interesting trigger condition where like it looks to be a really powerful skill, but it seems to be you can only use it after you evade an attack. So it seems to be like a conditional skill that that you have access to. So I wonder if that's like kind of leading kind of hinting at like maybe a more different philosophy and like some of the new attacks that they're introducing in this expansion for SMT5 Vengeance. You saw, you know, some returning demons coming back, like Azazel. I think one of the main figures in this trailer that a lot of Shin Megami Tensei veterans noticed right away is there's like this angelic demon with that descends from above.
Mastema?
Yeah, Mastema.
However you pronounce the name. What a bitch.
Yeah, exactly. So people don't know Mastema. He made his debut in Strange Journey, I believe, and is one of the key figures in the law route for that game. And is a very, like Adam said, he's a bitch. Because he's a very deceptive angel. That, you know, is willing to sacrifice a lot in the name of upholding law, let's say. So it's very funny to see Mastema return, obviously, with a new 3D model. We saw like a few more little bits. Like, you saw like I forgot the name of the Ichiro, I believe. He was like a guest character taking a selfie in battle.
Ichiro Desai. He's so stupid.
Yeah. So the did you see the trailer for this, Adam?
Nope. I saw some of the responses to it, but yeah, I'm very interested in this game. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw Mastema, and that's very exciting. Because he was in Strange Journey, and he hasn't really shown up since, has he? Anywhere?
I forgot if
he was in like 4 Apocalypse or something, because that game had a ridiculous roster, but I don't remember.
Yeah, it might have been in 4 Apocalypse, like a DLC or something like that, but definitely didn't have like an influence in there.
Right.
Yeah. So. This looks really exciting, and like, you know, we were talking about it earlier, Viv, before you came back, that like there seems to be like a new, like, you know, when they advertised that this will have a new dungeon, they showed off a little bit of that, and it kind of sort of has that Labyrinth of Amala feel and like in philosophy, because it shows like the a rotating environment, and like your whole surrounding environment is pretty much just a labyrinth you navigate through. So it's like, oh, okay, we actually, like, you know, maybe there'll be some meat to, like, you know, dungeon exploration in this game, like the base game. But I think this really, if anything, this trailer made the case that like this new canon of Vengeance route is going to be significantly different, because I think a lot of people were still kind of hesitant on like how different this new route would be, because they didn't really show too much of it. But I think more people are now convinced, like, oh no, they're really departing a lot from the original events of the game.
It gives the impression that this is just SMT4 Apocalypse again, except instead of it not including the original like game, it is now. Which
yeah, so it's very exciting.
Some of the most prominent feedback I saw from this trailer was like kind of almost angry, where it's like, damn it, you know, I played this game on Switch and it didn't run well, and it was only half the game, and blah blah blah. Like, I'm kind of like, I'm not planning to play this, because I did play the base game, and I'll like live vicariously through some segment of you all to see like how cool the all the added stuff is. And if it's immaculate and excellent, then maybe I'll earmark it. But like, I'm not feeling, I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Taken advantage of. Though I guess I'm more excited to be like, played at a good frame rate. Like, I played the base.
Yeah, game. Exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned I'm actually replaying Persona 5 right now, and just like how snappy it is. Like, man, it'll be nice when Shin Megami Tensei 5 is this snappy, just going through menus.
It's really funny.
Played it on console, and I'm playing PC.
Yeah,
it's really funny, because I remember when I did my video preview thing for the PC port of Persona 5, I was speeding through the menus, and I got multiple comments on both the videos, and like that also got posted on Reddit. Multiple comments on both being like, "How? Why the fuck is this dude going through the menus so fast?"
It lets you.
Yeah.
All right. This is the power of like having high frame rate in your turn-based RPGs. Menuing feels so much better. I know I bitched about it so much for the original release of SMT5.
It's funny, because they understood this back on the PlayStation 1. The frame rate for like Final Fantasy 7 wasn't great on the original PlayStation, but the menus ran at 60 FPS because they understood.
It's like, So yeah, that's still my most excited feature of this game. It's just like, hey, the menus will be responsive and it won't feel like shit to like navigate through battles. So I'm definitely, when it comes out, I'm there day one. I can't wait to. I'm a sucker for SMT mainline.
So. I'm gonna ask some stupid question. Did anybody play Final Fantasy VII Rebirth in graphics mode on the piano minigame?
No. Why would I?
That sounds crazy.
I played 90% of that game streamed to my Steam Deck, where it's like, why would I play graphics mode that way? There's no point. Actually, no point.
Did you do that, Chow?
No, I was thinking maybe if I slowed the game down, it might make it a little easier to get that star. I couldn't even get a fucking C with that. I was like, nope, I give up. Right, no graphics mode ever again. Never touching that shit.
The other update that we have, I don't know if we talked about this back, we were talking about Saga, but alongside the announcement of the demo, they did also do the character trailer and bio for D.Va number 5. D.Va number 5 is a mech, and we already kind of talked a little bit about how mechs work and a little bit about who the character is. The last kind of update for an upcoming, or not an upcoming game, a game that released last May, is an upcoming update to Night Dive's System Shock remake. This is a 1.1 update coming out on, let's see, May 21st, along with the console versions.
Actually, the PC update is like April 14th or something.
Oh, okay, I see it now, sorry. So it came out on PC last May. The 1.1 update is coming out on PC April 11th, yeah. And then it'll also be bundled into the console update, a console release for the game on May 21st. So this includes a female protagonist option, a reconfigured ending scenario, final boss, and then just like a slew of patch notes about like changing enemy AI behaviors, map layouts, things like that. Nothing that seems like explicitly a highlight, at least coming from my perspective.
I was looking through the list, and they did not mention Beta Grove at all. I don't think they adjusted
Beta Grove.
No.
Yeah, so the Beta Grove infamous area of the game. So a couple thoughts. I don't think the female protagonist, like, it's a silent protagonist first person, so it's a nice option to have, so I'm glad they included it. And then the final boss, like, it is infamously bad, and then, like, the remake was infamously faithful. So it's just like, yep, it's bad. We kept it bad. But now they're just like, no, actually, we're going to improve it. So I don't know exactly, like, what that'll look like. Not probably going to replay the game, but I guess they kind of said, like, okay, we made it faithful. Now we're going to see if we can make it better.
So I think one of the major things that, like, is in this update is, like, for people who are struggling to, like, find the way forward in this game, like, in the easy mission difficulty, they actually implemented, like, mission waypoints. So, like, if they don't know where to go, like, the game will actually explicitly tell them, hey, you can go here.
There are a few places where the game kind of had some, I don't know if you want to call it, like, 90s era design, where it's very obscure. Very like, you could, if you blinked and missed it, you could be running around multiple levels of this space station, not knowing what the hell you're supposed to do. And of course, you know, now you can just Google it and 10,000 websites will tell you exactly what to do. But there's the mechanics in the game that only ever show up once. And if you're not paying attention, you might miss it. Like, for instance, there's a part in the game where you have to bring a character's head to a retinal scanner to unlock a door, but it only happens once. So you're not even thinking that's like a verb in the game. Like, maybe I can pick up this guy's head and get me through the door. And if you miss that, I could see that being like, what the hell? What am I supposed to do? And then you're running around looking for a key forever.
Makes sense.
Or a key card. Yeah. And then the Beta Grove thing is basically like, the way the game is designed and intended, you have to go to a region of the space station that is radioactively, continuously drained your health. You can get some radioactive. I think the term in game is radioactive. It might just be environment. You can get some improvements, like tiers of your environmental resist before Beta Grove, but not high enough where it's enough to prevent it. So you might have like environmental resist level 1, and you're like, crap, Beta Grove kills me. I must need to upgrade this. And the answer is you can't until you go through it once without it upgraded. That's the intent.
Yeah, other games with similar sections, you would sort of think in the game design, oh, I have to find the thing that lets me through here on damage first, but there isn't. It's on the other side.
Yeah, the idea is you got to sprint through there and just keep your consumables ready, and at the and then later you get the upgrade, and then you can kind of go back and explore at your leisure. But yeah, I really enjoyed that game. Did not play the original. Played the Night Dive remake. It's got an immaculately like cool art style. I think it's voxel based, but I'm not sure. It's kind of like that high fidelity 3D pixel art. I can't really describe it. Go watch the trailer, but it's really, really, really cool.
There's a remaster coming out of the second game.
Mm-hmm. Part of me is like, maybe I'll just wait for Night Dive to get to it in 6 years.
Well, I think they said they don't really plan on remaking the second game. Yeah, they haven't. Because it's the difference between the first and second game originally was pretty significant, so it doesn't need a remake as severely, I guess. So, but they are remastering it.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll go into some sales updates. The aforementioned Unicorn Overlord has sold 500,000 units, which I believe makes it the fastest-selling Vanillaware game.
That is true, but it's also worth noting that, like, 13 Sentinels was PlayStation exclusive, so at the when it first released. So,
yeah,
several platforms versus one platform, but hey, that's part of the equation.
Yeah, but, you know, congratulations to Vanillaware. You know, they need to continue keeping the lights on and not personally use their bank accounts to make it past the finish line of development.
Yeah, stop running out of money halfway through the development.
I hope he's making bank. Yeah, if they go bankrupt, I'll be so mad.
Yeah, and in terms of like lifetime sales, we know that 13 Sentinels did hit 1 million after its Switch release, which was later. So
yeah,
that's sort of what we're looking at in terms of like, I don't think we got an update since then. I don't know if we got like a 1.5 or something like that, but you know, if Unicorn can hit 1 million, it'll at least be in the same ballpark.
I think it will. I think it definitely will. I think one of the, I really wonder how well the Grim Grimoire HD remaster sold when that silently came out last year.
Yeah.
And I'm like one of like maybe the five people in the US that
it. Hey, I have a copy.
Well, there you go. It makes a second one. Let's go. You know, they didn't say the sales figure for that.
Well, that was an NIS America thing, which is sort of weird too.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, they localized the original back in PS2, so it's probably a lot easier to deal with since they already have the script already fully translated, right?
Another recent release that got a sales update, Dragon's Dogma 2, which I know a handful of us are still working through, myself included, has surpassed 2.5 million copies sold, and then the whole series has surpassed 10 million copies sold. So, of course, anyone who was paying attention to like the Steam concurrent numbers were not released on Steam, even though did not receive very well due to the performance issues. It still sold very well and has already sold 2.5 million units. Still a fair cry behind the original, which kind of had a very, very long tail. And, of course, it had the Dark Arisen re-release, then it released on PC, and then it released on Switch. So it kind of had a time and opportunity to kind of...
It also got a shitload of like very good sales too. Like you can get that original game for $5 very regularly on sales.
Yeah.
So
now 2.5 million for two, and we'll see what sort of sales/tail we have on that one.
Does this Dragon's Dogma series also encompass? I don't know if you can count sales on Dragon's Dogma Online before that ended service. And did they ever release a Blu-ray for that Dragon's Dogma anime series that was on Netflix? Does that count?
I don't think it counts.
Okay. But yeah, this is probably double dipping on almost certainly original Dragon's Dogma and then Dark Arisen.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look at Capcom's like Platinum Games list, they have three different listings for Dragon's Dogma. They have like the original game, then they have like the first version of Dark Arisen, and then like the remastered version of Dark Arisen that came out on like PS4 and Xbox One. PC.
All right. When you said Capcom Platinum Games Collection, I was like, you mean Clover Studio?
No, they call titles that hit 1 million of platinum. But yeah, I get what you mean. So
that's a really strong showing for like just Dragon's Dogma 2 out of the gate. And that just barely came out. It's like already almost on its way to 3 million immediately. That's crazy, especially for that kind of game, that type of game, right? Because like. That's not really a mainstream type of game, I would say.
No.
Then the last update that I saw, actually I saw this over on Gamatsu.com, is that the God Wars series has top 400,000 sales. And then I have a little tiny short story here. I saw that, I'm like, God Wars, I haven't read about that in a while. Let me check to see if we've covered this. So I go into the RPG site search and I type in God Wars. I'm like, oh, we haven't covered this since 2018 when they announced the sequel. I guess we're not covering it anymore. Oh, wait, there hasn't been any updates on the God Wars 2 announcement since 2018?
Right. So I actually reviewed God Wars, the original version, back in 2017 or something like that, maybe 2016. I don't remember. Anyways, it was sort of weird because God Wars at the time, it was a Kadokawa game, and they released it, then they released like an expansion to it that changed a lot, and then they released like an updated version of it that changed even more, and these are like significant changes. And by the way, this is a tactical RPG where like the original version, you can only have 4 people in battle, and now you can have 6 and other things like that, so pretty significant. But anyways, they announced the sequel in 2018, and then after that, like, Kadokawa divested a lot of their games and studios and stuff to Dragami Games, and a lot of the stuff that NIS America localized got delisted as a part of this. So I was sort of under the impression, oh, that sequel is dead. But the fact that they, like, bothered to announce this sales update makes me think maybe it's still somewhere in the pipeline. I don't know.
And we're laughing about this too, because they're saying the God Wars series consisting of the original game and then like an expansion, but like an expanded version of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's the series. And it's like, okay, and not to mention that there's not God of War, there's God Wars.
Yeah, very different.
Yes.
And with those sales updates down, we'll go into upcoming important dates. The first date I have listed is that the Saga Emerald Beyond demo was made available on April 4th, so a couple days ago at the time of recording. Later in April, on April 19th, we have the closed beta access for PC for an open world action RPG, Where Winds Meet. This is from Everstone Studio.
Yeah, I put a link to like the beta signups if you're interested in applying for it. They're gonna have it up until I think they're gonna distribute like codes for it like just in a few days. And then
I hope that as good as the trailers look, because the trailers look very over top.
Like, yeah, the trailers look really good for this game. I really hope like I did apply for it. I'm hoping I get in to give it a shot, because The footage for this game looks really fucking cool in the trailers that they've shown. I don't know how that translates anything to like actual gameplay though. So yeah, I mean, I'm always down for like more Wuxia style inspired games, you know, especially after Wandering Sword last year. So I'm hoping for the best.
Oh yeah, looking at this trailer, I'm gonna sign up for this too. This looks dope.
Later in April, we've got the release date for Class of Heroes Anniversary Edition and Class of Heroes 2G Remaster Edition, launching on April 26th for PlayStation, Nintendo Switch, and PC.
I've seen people kind of like get confused or even angry about like the titling of these games. Like, why is one Anniversary Edition and one 2G Remaster Edition? And
the 5G edition.
Well, the actual answer to that is that like the second game was a PSP game, and then it got like a PS3 like remaster already, and so it's like being remastered a second time, and they call that 2G. So that's why it's called 2G Remastered Edition, where the first game didn't get that, so they can't call it 1G. It's like, so it's basically based on history. They get different names. It's kind of weird.
Man, that's so confusing. It's even more confusing than Street Fighter back in the day. Champion Edition? What the heck is Champion Edition?
I don't know. It's not that confusing compared to Street Fighter.
And there's Turbo. Like, let's say if you came in late, how do you know which one came first? Like, is it Turbo? Is it the Champion Edition? Which one?
Heading into, also in April, on April 30th, Front Mission 2 Remake, which originally launched on Switch late last year in October, will be launching for PlayStation, Xbox, and PC like I said, on April 30th. And on PC, it'll be available on Steam, Epic, and GOG.
So, I don't know. I haven't really been following news on this game, but I know when this game originally came out on Switch, the a really big complaint of it was the translation of it. Did they ever fix up that English script on this game? Because the screenshots I saw of it back then looked pretty bad, and I don't know if they ever did any patches to make that better.
I heard they improve a little bit, but it wasn't enough or something like that. I also heard, wasn't it like machine translated or some shit?
It kind of read like it, but I'm not sure if it was ever confirmed, but it definitely read like it. So there's also like speculation saying they just kind of lifted the script directly from like the original version on like this or something.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and it looks like it did get a quick patch in October with new translations, but it seems like it, like Chao said, it was a drop in the water. Like they touched up a few of the most egregious, but the rest is still not great. And then it hasn't been updated since.
That is not looking good then for Forever Entertainment. I know they've been partnering with other studios, like different studios, for these Front Mission remakes, but it still bums me out because like these like remakes feel like they could have been like so much more. And then like. I really like Front Mission 3 a lot, and we'll see how that goes.
To be clear, it's sort of weird in that, so Forever Entertainment is a Polish studio, and they're Storm Trident, Forever Entertainment, and whatever the third one is, Mega something, I forget. They're all actually part of the same umbrella, so it's
okay.
It's like, it's technically the same studio.
Okay.
It's like the same group anyway.
I got confused because they're also the publisher, so I was thinking, there was like some sort of like... They're just an external publisher partnering with them. And they're almost
They're connected somehow. Okay. I forget who the developer of the third game is, but it's also technically Forever Entertainment. I'm gonna look this up.
And this Front Mission 2 remake is gonna be priced at $35. Is that on other platforms?
Like first game didn't have like a translation issue because it just lifted from the DS.
Yeah, I think I was thinking of that when I was mentioning that, and then Front Mission 2 didn't have that, so that's why the translation quality seems fucked up because it didn't have like a original base for it, like the first Front Mission. So that I think that's where I got confused. Fuck man, that's still a bummer though. like after all this time, it's to hear that's like it's only gotten like not really and many improvements. It's like those were bad, man. What the fuck? What are we doing?
I think your only resort is to play a fan translation. Does a fan translation even exist?
Okay, so is that the thing I'm waiting for? Is like a fucking PC mod to like get a better fucking English script?
You know, sometimes they resort to like desperate measures because these companies don't, you know, did the bare minimum. Yeah. So we should.
If that's the case, then like fuck it, man. I'll wait for like the dedicated fans to like fix it up. Take it.
Heading into May, we have the release date on May 9th for King Arthur Legion 9. If you don't remember what this was originally announced as an expansion to the tactical RPG that came out in 2022, King Arthur Knight's Tale, which is like the King Arthur mythos only as a CRPG and very, very grimdark. And then it's now going to be a standalone experience in the King Arthur Knight's Tale universe, is the way they're calling it. They actually use the term universe. That is launching on May 9th.
Yeah, so this is from NeoCore Games, which is they're probably known for like some of the Van Helsing kind of like AA RPGs the last couple of years. This is a weird announcement because it was originally an expansion, but now it's like a separate thing.
Yeah, from what I understand, it's like in the same world still as like that original Knight's Tale game, because in Knight's Tale you played as like Mordred, and now in this one you play as Gaius Julius Mento.
I remember when this came out in 2022, I was interested in it, but like I just don't have any affinity for like the King Arthur mythos or lore at all, so I didn't. So basically, it was a curiosity at most, and then, as always, a lot of games came out.
Apparently, I mean, people's understanding of King Arthur these days is just through the Fate series.
My understanding of King Arthur is from the Capcom beat 'em up game.
Knights of the Round. I was thinking of like that other game. It was like something Earth. I forgot what it was called, but it wasn't that.
No, but I always think of the Capcom one. It's like you level up from getting your score higher, and the best character is fucking Percival. Guys, always pick Percival.
Just like in Grand Blue, right?
Yeah, because Lancelot's a loser.
Continuing for May, on May 30th, also for PC, we're having the release date of Scald Against the Black Priory. This is a Raw Fury published title from developer Scape ITAS.
I don't know. Which is a solo dev. Title.
Oh, it is a solo dev.
Yep.
The trailer for this is really cool.
it's a live action trailer. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's a live action trailer that's like very designed to be like how video game commercials were like in the 90s. So you kind of have like the game like on a CRT displayed in it, or like just not even a CRT, like just like a very old computer monitor that was still bulky. So we've covered this game before. Adam has, and this is a game very, very inspired by Ultima and Goldbox RPGs.
Yeah, this looks like stuff that came out in the 90s, at least on PC anyways.
Yeah. So, I know a lot of people who were who have fondness for this, like, have had their eyes on this game. And then they also released a demo for this game, like an updated demo, so it's like the latest iteration of the game is now represented in that updated demo, so... If you're interested in that kind of game, there's a demo up on Steam to try out.
And last date we have here is that Kurono Koseki 2 in Japan is going to be releasing on Nintendo Switch on July 25th.
And this is kind of...
I forgot it wasn't already on Switch.
Yeah.
Well, I mean... They're very obviously speedrunning getting the arc on Switch, which this tells me one thing. Kai no Kiseki will be day one on Switch because they ported Kuro 1 in February, and this is coming out in July. So obviously they're trying to make sure that the series is there so that when Kai drops, theoretically people can just hop onto that. Now, how many people are going to beat both Kuro 1 and Kuro 2 before Kai comes out, considering the Switch version of Kai, the Switch version of Kuro 2 is the end of July, and Kai is presumably going to be 2 months later at the end of September? Anyone's guess, but still.
I mean, it kind of further confirms, because when they announced Kai no Kiseki, they were being very coy about like which platforms it'll release on.
I'm guessing part of it was they weren't sure if they were going to be able to get all the ports out in time, so that would be my guess.
Yeah.
That'd be my guess.
So I think it's pretty safe to say that like PlayStation and maybe the Switch version will be day one in Japan for that game.
And that covers me for the announcements and dates that we had for this week's episode of the podcast.
Yeah.
Any other concluding thoughts before we... Before we adjourn?
Let's see. I'm trying to think here. I don't think there's any big... Oh, yeah, we saw that. We discussed it at the end of last week's episode, but there's going to be that Triple I Initiative event this week that'll have like a bunch of like indie games on it. We'll see if there's anything relevant to us there. Other than that, it's going to be slow going until like all the games hit late April. It's not going to be that crazy.
Yeah, the game coming out in the next week that I'm most interested in, by the time you're listening to this podcast, might already be out. Broken Roads, the game that was emergency delayed, is coming out in a couple of days. And I'm interested. I guess I'm more curious than like excited, but maybe those are two sides of the same coin. So maybe next week we'll talk a little bit about that, and we'll see what other people get up to and figure it out from there. We play it by ear. You're on the Tethercast. We don't always plan.
I'm surprised we always found content even on like a drought kind of time, because it's so busy this year.
Well, we're kind of at a point now where like so-and-so will play Dragon's Dogma the first week, and the second week, someone else will make significant progress, and then the third week, another person will make progress. So usually it's kind of best, in my opinion, to kind of bundle the discussions together rather than to, like, trickle it out as each person in turn gets around to playing these games. And we try to always line it up so multiple people can kind of kick back their opinions on a given title. So we'll see. But thank you all so much for listening to the TetraCast. You can find the Unicorn Overlord review up on the site at rpgsite.net. All the news posts are up there as well. You can find RPG Site on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for RPG Site, and you should find us. If you listen to this podcast and you enjoy it, whether it's on the site or on whatever your podcast service of choice is, go ahead and leave us a comment or a rating. We do like to see those. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGSite. And as always, we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. Until you hear from us then, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.
We really spent half of this podcast talking about the Emerald Beyond demo.
You should all download and play it.
Turn-based sickos.